Up next on episode 56 of Stack Overflow, Joel and Jeff sit down with Jason Calcanis to discuss the business side of software, including Mahalo's skee-ball economy, when VC funding is appropriate, and whether search engine optimization matters, from IT Conversations. Hi, this is Phil Windley. Today I'm excited to bring you another great program from Stack Overflow with Joel Spolsky and Jeff Atwood here on IT Conversations.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media.
And now, here's Stack Overflow.
Audacity. It's pretty dope.
Yeah, at one point I decided that I was taking this seriously enough that I needed to...
Educate yourself on audio?
Yeah. And so I was going to get whatever. What is Cool Edit now called? They got a new name for it. Audition. Adobe Audition. So I'm like, I'm going to learn how to do this, or Pro Tools or something like that. And it's just too complicated. It just blew my mind with all the...
I think
features.
It's the 10,000 hour rule. Like, it's going to take thousands of hours for you to become proficient at it.
Yep.
And you might not have that much time in your life.
And somehow, like Audacity, I was able to just, you know, it's just like cutting and pasting the little sound things. And
yeah, it's pretty cool.
And it's fine.
I did my first podcast on my own with that.
With Audacity?
Yeah, it worked pretty well. You could level things and
right.
You cut and paste, clip things. Yeah.
Are you guys both in New York?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're in the same office.
Oh, okay.
Oh, well, that's not fair.
We're hanging out together.
Yeah.
You guys are like buddies. That's great.
So, Jason, you're here for New York Internet Week?
I am here for Interweb Week.
What do they do? What is that?
Internet Week is basically a marketing campaign to get people psyched about the internet in New York City and the companies here, I guess. I mean, we used to have the Silicon Alley Reporter events and stuff like that.
Yeah, you used to be Mr. New York Silicon Alley.
A lot of people credit me with the term Silicon Alley, which is not true, but...
Whose term was it, really?
I did a LexisNexis search back in the day, and I found somebody had used it to describe, like, Boston or Philadelphia or something like that.
We don't have alleys in New York. That's the one thing about Manhattan that Manhattan does not have.
Not really, no.
We
have, like, weird curvy streets down in Chinatown.
Right.
But not...
No,
like,
there's no alleys.
Not really alleys. Once in a while in Tribeca, but...
That's how you can always tell the fake movie that was filmed in Vancouver that... pretends to be filmed in New York.
Like The Dark Knight or something. Yeah.
Yeah, is that they're always going down alleys, which don't really exist.
No. Thanks for having me. I'm a huge fan of Stack Overflow, even though I'm no longer a developer. And when I was a developer, I was quite horrible.
Well, that's exactly what Stack Overflow is for.
I mean, I was...
You would fit right in, Jason.
I was more like a database admin network architect. I used to be a Novell certified engineer.
Wow.
Oh, nice.
I used to also install Banyan Vines. Token ring, and I used to crimp
RG58 cables. There are technologies that are completely gone.
Token ring is gone.
Token ring, Banyan Vines.
Do you remember Token ring, like the big, huge black plug? It looked like something out of like Aliens or something. You'd plug into the back. I mean, only IBM could make
that.
It looked like a Borg type thing. It was.
Yep.
Where are those connectors now? Like, gosh. So I installed the first Novell network at Amnesty International. That was like my first gig here in Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
Crimped the cables.
Were you like working as an independent consultant or something, or did
I grew up in Brooklyn, right across the street here. And when I went to school at Fordham, my parents were broke, so there's no way to pay for school. So I got a job in the computer lab because I had an IBM PC Junior when I was a kid, and I was a little hacker script kiddie with a 300 baud Ventel modem.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to be a co-sysop on a bulletin board where we used to trade hack software and whatever.
Right.
And phone codes and sprint codes and all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. I would not say I was a hacker. I think I was a kid on BBSs learning how to do stupid things. But then when I came to Manhattan, I was a psychology major at Fordham here in the city, and I needed a way to pay for school. So they were like, oh, go work in the computer lab. So I went down there for $2.50 an hour.
Is that legal?
That was the minimum wage in 1998, actually.
That's it, really?
And then minimum wage went up to $3.50, I think. Or it was a huge day when that happened. I got fired from that job.
What did you do?
It's like, I'm just thinking about it now. There's this woman, Esther, who ran the computer lab. And so we got some computers with hard drives in them, and I partitioned the hard drive.
Oh, and so you could have a secret partition.
Yeah, so I made a secret partition to put my games on and my files, because I don't want to run around with a bunch of 5 1/4-inch floppies.
Come on, doesn't everybody do that at school?
Right, so... I also put a keyboard locker on her computer. But anyway, the keyboard locker is probably not a good idea. But
that was a very bad idea.
But she didn't find out about that. Esther, if you're listening,
we'll find her. We'll find
keyboard
her.
Keyboard locker at Fordham University. But anyway, somebody told on me. So she fired me.
Hmm.
And then this guy, Tristan, who ran the computer lab at the MBA program, was looking for somebody. And he found out I got fired for partitioning the hard drive.
And he needed some hard drives partitioned.
He didn't know how to partition a hard drive. So somebody set me up there and said, hey, we heard you know how to partition hard drives. And I said, yeah. And he said, great. You want a job? And I said, sure. He says, well, it's only $6.50 an hour. And I was like, I'll take it. And so then I spent a couple of years at Fordham essentially copying software illegally for MBA students.
Right.
So they'd be like, I need a copy of SPSS, you know, the statistics software, and can you make a copy of these 20 floppies for me? And I was like, yeah, $50, boom. So I was running all kinds of scams out of the computer. But I worked for a company called Barrister here. I worked for Amnesty International full-time. Mm-hmm. I basically was, you know, a network architect. Mm-hmm. And then I wound up working for a company called Land Systems, putting in 400 node legal systems and document management systems like PC Docs and... You know,
those were sort of pre-PC generation.
Yeah, you basically document management was a big deal, and so version control wasn't built into word processors, so there was all this add-on software. So it was it was pretty horrible. I was like under desks crimping RJ58 cables that like somebody would kick it and then it would come out. But anyway, then I started Silicon Reporter magazine at night, just to write about the internet because I was so fascinated by it.
Right, and that's when it all happened.
And that was 1995, 96, and then it grew into a 300-page magazine. It had 70 employees.
Wow. I still have somewhere. I should go find
you. Well, you met back in those days at NINMA or something.
Could be. I still have this issue that was like the top 100 Silicon Alley companies or something.
That was
like your last issue.
Well, if it had the Hindenburg on it, that was the last issue. And the one everybody remembers was the one where we did everybody as Sgt. Pepper's, the cover of the Sgt. Pepper's album.
Oh, cool.
We photoshopped it.
But I should go dig that out of the library and see how many of those companies are still around.
Yeah, there's like 10, you know, like iVillage and DoubleClick, and some of them still exist.
Right.
Most of them don't. But, you know, that was a crazy period. But yeah,
cool. So, Jeff, what's new in the Stack Overflow server fault? That we got to follow the format, even though we have an illustrious guest.
Illustrious.
This is our policy when we have guests on. We don't want to just turn this into an interview show because there's a million places where people interview Jason Calacanis. We're just gonna do our own boring shtick and just
not boring.
We know you'll come.
Well, congratulations on the second, whatever it is, Q&A system.
Oh, knowledge exchange. Server fault. Yes, the second. That's true. We don't have a name for this thing.
Knowledge exchange. That's what they call it in Korea. You know, this all started Q&A services in Korea at a site called Naver, and another one called Hatina in Japan.
Huh.
And Yahoo Answers copied that, like literally photocopied it.
You're kidding.
So I spent a lot of time in Japan.
So Yahoo Answers was really the first mass market
in the United States.
In the States,
but in Korea and Japan, these other services, Daum.net.
Yeah,
they all
them.
Started it and.
They bought Lycos, which
they
is
did.
Sort of weird.
bizarre. But those two companies have 70 and 20% market share in Korea.
Right.
Google has like 3.
Right.
And it's because people, their primary way to get information is through knowledge exchange, not search.
Interesting. Because I actually, did you hear that, Jeff? Korea, knowledge exchange, not search?
I did.
Jeff. We had a debate a few months ago about... I guess my point was, you know, we're a startup, we're bootstrapped, we can't just like hire some guy to go do a Chinese version and a Korean version and a Japanese version of Stack Overflow. And so what's going to happen and is already happening is some Chinese programmer is going to make a complete clone of the site down to the logo.
They do that pretty well in China.
Yeah. And in fact, you probably just go to Guangzhou or something, you go down to the factory district, you find a factory, and you're like, make a clone of this website.
Actually, the Germans do it better than anybody.
Right.
Yeah, the Germans are notorious. They copied Facebook, Dig. So, there's a thing called Plig, I think. No, Plig is the open source one. There's some in Germany, they copied Dig like the week it came out.
In Germany, they probably copied it, though, without like literally copying the CSS and stuff. Like, they probably have some basic sense that copyright violations are... Anyway, but the trouble is that those, there's so many examples where those local ones then become hugely popular.
Yep.
And like later when we do have time to hire somebody to go to China
and compete with them,
you either have to buy them or compete with them. And if you compete with them, you probably lose because they're more native and they're more ingrained. And
I think what you should do is what Facebook did. They had their users translate the product. It was one of the most successful and innovative things Facebook
did. So they basically just exposed a translation
they basically said
interface.
A translation interface was like, here, you know, this says vote. You know, what? How do you say vote in all these other languages? And then they just filled it in themselves. And so as time went on, and you can put it all into the same domain name. But it's a pain in the ass to buy all these domain names. Like, do you own StackOverflow.de? You're not going to. So
you probably don't have to. I mean,
you don't have to.
Slash.
Well, wait. Does Mahalo even have localized versions?
Not yet. We wanted to hit 10 million, 15 million uniques before we did that.
See, they're not doing it either, Joel.
No. That's true. It's, you know, it's a lot of work. We did do it with Engadget and Joystick and Autoblog, and that was slightly easier because it was just a blog. Mm-hmm. So we hired people for, just like we did in the United States, $10 a blog post, $12 a blog post, and said, copy stuff. And Engadget was in five languages, but the real...
But they were linking to stuff. Those are blogs, so they're linking, and they're linking to stuff that's in English.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, Engadget was writing reviews and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, I mean, the really interesting part was we had in Japan, there's a place called Akihabara, which is the, like, gadget complex. So we would have reporters go to Akihabara.
Gadgets, comic books, and anime, weird and blow-up dolls.
Oh, man, it is trippy. I mean, they have maid cafes there where they serve you. Oh, master...
Right,
like cosplay kind of girls, like serving you, like, oh, here's your tea and your cake, and you're just like, this is weird. It's like, it's not sexual,
yeah,
but it's wildly deviant.
Right, right. It's all the deviance without any of the sexuality.
Deviant. That's great.
It's very,
that's possibly the best description I've ever heard of that.
Yeah, but the interesting thing was that was our advantage over Gizmodo and a lot of other places. It was a secret sauce. Was that we had reporters in Taiwan, in Shenzhen, in Akihabara, sending us information, and then we put it into English and be like, hey, here's these spy shots. It was like, yeah, spy shots from Japan.
Right, from a store where they're selling it right next to the subway station.
One of the most popular features ever on Engadget was keeping it real fake, where we would
I remember that.
They literally would be like, keeping it real fake, you know, iPod Shuffle clones, because when the iPod Shuffle came out, the little chiclet size one or whatever, like a matchbook size one, there were like 50 clones of it. You know, in these different places. Anyway, but knowledge exchange is the big way they do it over there. And Naver is blocking, they no-indexed their knowledge base from Google.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, you talk about how to beat Google and people are like, oh, Rupert Murdoch and all these guys are stupid. Like, they don't understand.
Right.
If all the newspaper companies no-indexed and Google results came up with no news, or like 10 newspapers did it, Google would be seriously screwed.
Yeah.
And that's what they're doing in Korea. Like, you can't spider the knowledge exchange.
Didn't they try to do that in Belgium, too, or something? Or
it will work.
Yeah.
It really devalues. If the New York Times wasn't in Google and the top 10 newspapers in this country, it would seriously devalue Google. And if Yahoo and, you know, say Microsoft with their new search engine did, you know, give them some sort of payment for indexing them, that would be a game changer. I know it sounds anti-internet, anti-competitive, but that's what they're doing in Korea.
But the newspapers would have to all trust each other and act as a consortium and all. I mean, they'd also let somebody break ranks and then the whole thing would be screwed.
Exactly. And would also have to be embracing the future as opposed to scared of it. And that's, you know, their businesses are based on preserving revenue streams that are destined to decline.
It's amazing how rapidly the newspaper thing has come on. I mean, I think everybody, you know, in technology sort of saw that coming. They're like, okay, Craigslist is cannibalizing all your income really badly. You're not really getting the whole internet thing with a rare few exceptions. It was just a matter of time before, you know, you had to go pay the piper.
It would be as if...
All of a sudden now, right?
I think it would be like if I told you, like, by the way, there's a tsunami that's going to hit this beach in 7 years, 8 years, and you're like... Yeah, okay. And then you just like, you kept going to that beach and you camped out there and you built a house there. It's like, it's f-ing coming, guys. Like, I don't know if I can curse on this. You just lost your iTunes rating.
I don't believe that. Have one.
It was like, yeah, like we're just going to wait here on the beach to get hit by the tsunami. I mean, they built like an $18 trillion building in Manhattan. Like, why not spend like $100 million building 10 blog properties?
It is sort of interesting that they don't even... But the weird thing is it's not necessarily like... The trouble is the New York Times looks at the web and they think, you know, how can I do a New York Times-like thing on the web?
Right.
And actually what's going to probably work on the web is not New York Timesy. So it's sites like Mahalo and Stack Overflow, right?
It's their DNA is different. Yeah, they can't conceive of like Stack Overflow, just like they can't conceive of Dig or blogs. It's just not in their DNA.
Right.
They just started blogging.
Yeah, and the trouble is it's just sort of embarrassing to watch them try to do it. Anyway, I don't want to talk about that descent of journalism.
All right, well, back to, Stack Overflow.
So enough about me. What do you think about Stack Overflow, Jason?
I'm actually a huge fan of what you guys are doing. Can I tell you my favorite parts of the site?
Sure.
I think the thing that you guys have done best is the badges.
Uh-huh.
I'm a big Call of Duty fan. I don't know if you guys ever played this.
Well, that was the first game that I played on Xbox 360.
Yeah.
And so
that's the only game Joel has ever played. You picked the one game.
I played Half-Life and Halo and
Command and Conquer, Age of Empires.
Yeah, we played all the same games.
I like real-time strategy better than the first-person shooter. I think it's like more like chess. But anyway.
The badges were just going by as I was playing Call of Duty. I wasn't even noticing them.
Right.
But I do know that people collect incessantly.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, what I remember is like my days back in the Israeli army where you would get like little tiny badges for various campaigns, campaign ribbons.
Yeah.
And it was occasionally some guy would walk by and you'd be like, what's that cool purple thing that he has on his heart?
I want that. He's like, you get this if you dress up like a woman at a fruit market and then kill 90-year-old Nazis.
Exactly.
Like, what was that, Munich?
Yeah.
And they go
sometimes they just can't tell you.
Yeah.
Or like I remember there were these guys, I was in the paratroopers and we had these little wing thingies, but you got under different rules, you got to put a different color background behind your wings.
Oh, sweet.
So like I had
fuchsia.
Blue, but some people had green and some people had black. And if you were an instructor, you got red. It was insane.
Pink.
Yeah.
pink. Badges are cool. And I'm writing an article for my email newsletter about the badge. I was just writing some things I've learned about community building.
Uh-huh.
And I mentioned the badges you guys have. And we're absolutely stealing that very soon.
Yeah. We stole it ourselves. In fact,
where did you take it from?
Xbox.
Oh, from Xbox. Right. Yeah. So, but it's the first time I've seen anybody put it on the web. Has anybody put badges on the web before you? I searched. I couldn't find a badge type system.
Actually, doesn't. Maybe I'm misremembering this, but doesn't Yahoo Answers have like a sort of a weird little badges and award system that goes with their accounts?
I don't think they have that. They have like how many questions?
I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking of like, well, AskVille. It's like the same thing.
Maybe AskVille has it. But yours is like the one I like, the peer pressure one the best. It's like you ask a question and it sucks.
Right.
And then you take it down
yourself.
You
delete yourself.
That's brilliant. I mean, it's.
How did you come up with those, Jeff?
Well, a lot of them we came up with because we thought, okay, what behaviors do we actually want to encourage on the site? So every badge that's on there, actually quite a bit of thought goes into creating most of those badges because we don't want to have perverse incentives where you create a badge just because you think it's going to be for fun. But for the people using the site, it becomes very serious. Like they really get involved in this, they get caught up in the race to get these things.
Yeah.
And they'll do things you necessarily wouldn't want them to do to get these badges. So you have to make sure that you're rewarding the right behaviors.
Yeah,
in other words,
that's
behaviors
very complicated.
That
yeah.
make the site better, that make them look good, make you look good, et cetera, et cetera. So whenever we put a badge together, I thought about, you know, what would make this person look good, make our site look good, you know, increase the quality of the site. And those are the kinds of things we want to reward more than anything else.
It's literally the best part of the site. And I think what's brilliant about it is, like, obviously, if you get it right, it's like one less thing you have to manage, you know, like if they're deleting stuff, whatever. And the sponsor one for Woot, is Woot sponsoring that one?
Yeah. That
is truly brilliant.
Well, that'll go away. That'll become, what's it going to be called after the...
Visit for 30 days. It's like the loyalty.
Enthusiast.
Yeah. That's why it's alphabetized there.
No, leave it as Woot forever. Well, and it should be like Woot 30, Woot 90, Woot 120. You know, Woot launched on Engadget.
Really?
Yeah.
They're good. Avatar. They support. They know how to support the smart sites.
Yeah.
And you know what? They support the sites that just go to that their programmers go to.
Yeah.
That's how they know what. I mean, that's how they found
us. Not dissimilar to Apple. Mm-hmm. When we tried to get Apple to advertise in Silicon Eye Reporter, we went to their agency and we're like, "What's it going to take?" Like, you know, we showed them all these statistics of how many Apple people there were and designers in New York, and they're like, "Listen, Steve Jobs gives us a list." And I was like, what? So like Steve Jobs picks what magazines Apple advertises in.
Right.
And I was like, no way. He's got the time to do that. Isn't he making stuff? And
that's all he does.
And they're like, no, like Utne Reader.
Yeah.
I'd be like, Utne Reader has Apple ads. It's got a circulation like half a Silicon Reporter. It's like this wonky thing. I'm like,
right.
You've got the back cover, the front cover.
But it's the Steve Jobs Bible.
Yeah. So it's like, whatever.
Yeah.
That's also pretty interesting.
There's something we should talk about, Jason. This is what everybody wants to hear about.
Oh, okay.
I've been going around, you know, Google Answers closed.
Yes.
And I get the feeling that the Google Answers closed because they tried to make a money economy where they paid you for your answers.
Sure, yeah.
And the amount that they could pay you was so little.
Yep.
That everybody starts saying, am I willing to do this for $1 or for $2? That's right. Just sort of ridiculous. So, for example, I've spent hours writing some elaborate answers and testing source code that I post to Stack Overflow that 17 right. people are ever going to see.
Right. And why do you
But if you told me how much would I take for that, I mean, I've literally turned down $20,000 speaking gigs
right.
that would have taken 1 hour.
Sure. Right. So this is the thing about incentives, right? They're different for different people. There is a multitude of reasons of why somebody does something.
Right.
And perhaps I haven't done a great job of explaining why we have a currency in there and why we added it. So it's great to be here to talk about it. I don't think that money is the primary driver. As a matter of fact, I was a psychology major, and I can tell you it's not. Recognition and affiliation and fun are actually the drivers of online communities.
So without – I don't want to interrupt you too much,
yeah.
but I
no,
feel like
do it.
What happens then is as soon as you add money, then that displaces the community and or it makes people think they're doing it for the money.
Correct. That
and
is
it sort
that
of
is
pushes
a risk.
Away some of the as soon as you pay somebody $1 to do something, there's
right.
no way they can tell themselves that they're doing it out of the love of their heart and the dollar.
Correct.
Is just
it's like
cream
that
cheese.
Study, like here, play Call of Duty, you'll love it. I pay you $1 per hour. You're like, this is a drag. I'm only
right.
getting $1.
Right.
Right.
I did that study with Call of Duty.
Yeah. Exactly. That's how you got yourself to stop playing. So I call this the skee ball economy, and it's a very delicate balance on how to do this. People play skee ball. You guys know what that is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Skee ball, you throw the ball down the thing, tickets come out of the machine.
Oh, okay.
Gotta,
got it.
Do you ever play that?
No, but I believe you.
You've played
what?
It?
What? You've never played skee ball, Joel? What? Really?
Skee ball is when you go to like the Jersey Shore.
Bro, okay.
And then they have like a row of like ramps with little holes, and you
right.
throw
okay,
the ball
got it.
Up, and then it lifts in the air, and if you get it in,
and
then
you win
tickets
something
come
that
out.
Looks like a plush animal, but is
right.
actually a toilet paper tube.
Something, yeah.
Surrounded by.
But anyway, we used to play skee ball for a long time, and you know, you throw the balls up there, you get points. It was fun to play skee ball.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody loves skee ball. And you would get tickets that would come out, and ding, 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 ding. You take the tickets, and then
right.
either you would cash them in that night, or that summer, or that week, or that month, to get a frisbee or something. You weren't doing it for the tickets; you were doing it for the fun of it.
Right.
But then there was this like little fun thing you did afterwards, which was cash in the items, and that's what's called the token economy in psychology.
Right.
It's taking it's a light driver of behavior, and if you look at Mahalo Answers, we get a lot of people who come. Because they're like, oh, there's a token economy here. I can make money. And they're like, oh, you can't really make a lot of money.
Right.
But if you look at it compared to Yahoo Answers, where you can make none, it's this nice little incentive.
Mm-hmm.
And so what actually happened was most of the people don't use the money. They don't cash out. Like 10 people cash out a month, 15 people, and they take out $100 or $200. There's 25 people who have Mahalo Answers started a Kiva group called Mahalo Answers Kiva, and you can Google it, and they've donated $900 to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually becomes a sort of secondary driver, but you are correct. There is a risk that, oh my God, they're going to perceive it as the primary driver.
Right. So we have, I mean, that's why we have just pure points,
yeah.
and you get points, and you can feel proud about earning them.
What you've got is an expert economy. The people
yeah.
who participate in Stack Overflow, or open source for that matter, are, I think, their primary motivation is to show off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good at this. Look at me,
mm-hmm.
which is a big part of developer culture, and to get more jobs. Like, I mean, if you're
yeah.
one of the top users in the PHP category, or the, you know, now if you're the top guy in the, you know, Memcache or whatever,
right.
you know, or Nginx. Like, I'm looking for an Nginx guy for Mahalo. I look on your server, Stack Overflow, and I'm gonna be like, wow, there's a guy who's answered 17 questions about Nginx.
Yep.
I want to hire him.
Yep.
So what you're doing is actually
you're going to pay us.
Well, or maybe, or it's just like
yeah.
you know, like when we had Hadoop issues at Mahalo, we went to the
right.
Hadoop mailing list. We looked at the people who had the most intelligent comments,
sure.
and we brought them in, and we paid them $300 an hour to do a Hadoop class at Mahalo for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just changing that's the expertise economy. Where you're exchanging your expertise in the system, your rank in the system for money later.
Mm-hmm.
You're exchanging. The fact that you own the system with fame for fog to get people to use your software.
Right.
And it's also become a business. But, you know, from the podcast, right? You don't make money from the podcast, but it brings people in and makes them more passionate about Stack Overflow.
Advertising, yeah.
So, you know, you can sort of trade the incentives, but I don't look at the world through just money as a driver. I think money is a driver in some cases, like in blogging. We paid people to blog. We were the first people to do that. We had 500, 600 people freelancing getting paid to blog.
Well, also on the Netscape.com dig redesign, you paid people to.
That's a whole other fiasco, which we can get into. But on the, it's a very interesting topic to me because I do think there, I'm not so much into sort of creating the financial system to sort of get something out of people. It's more, I like to take work that was previously undercompensated or not compensated and make it into a career. So blogging, I'm very proud of the fact that we were the company, Weblogs Inc., that made blogging into a career. People weren't getting paid and blogging about Apple. And we said, oh, blog on Tua, the unofficial Apple weblog, and we'll pay you $10 a post. And they were like, you're an idiot. I'm doing this for free.
Yeah.
And we're like, well, let us be idiots because we're making money and we want to share it with you. And those people wound up becoming full-time bloggers making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year.
Yeah, I think before you started, there was Jason Kotke had decided to take a year off and try to see if he could have a go at it. And then, of course, the problem is trying to find if you're all on your own as a sponsor, trying to get sponsors lined up and stuff like that is
very hard. That's why we had that's why Weblogs Inc. worked. We had this huge group of people building the sites, and then we handled infrastructure, ad sales, distribution, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's not my primary thing. People didn't blog on Engadget because of the money. In fact, a lot of them would quit jobs where they made more money. The second editor. The managing editor, Ryan Block, at Engadget, left a job where he was making close to six figures as a server admin to become a blogger on Engadget and took a 50% pay cut. But he loved it more, and as we increased his compensation, he spent more time doing it. Mm-hmm. So sometimes when you increase compensation in these systems, it just allows people to do it more, which was what I was trying to do at Netscape, but I only could work on that for 3 months. But we offered, I think, the top 25 people on Dig $1,000 a month to be... like community managers.
Yeah.
We weren't saying you, well, and it wasn't just to submit, it was to lead discussions, it was to remove spam, take everything they learned at Dig and put it over there. Of the 25 we offered, 23 of them took it.
But I've never, see, the reason I thought that was a little bit weird is because what you were paying people to do, I hate to say this, but it's a little bit like paying for sex, which is like, I've never had any trouble getting people to do that for free.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so. I get it. I understand that point, perspective.
It seems like you're applying money at the one point where most people just don't really actually have a problem getting people to contribute to community sites. If the community site is interesting.
I may have made a mistake there. But I thought as an experiment, having them involved, submitting, and teaching people how to use Netscape. And Netscape actually was, you know, the only traffic to Netscape were people who didn't know how to change the default on
their
browser
that they'd had for years.
That's it. And so it was trailing way down, and it got down to like 3.5 million uniques. When we launched Netscape, the page views like quadrupled, and it went from 3.5 uniques to 5. Mm-hmm. So it actually worked. People were really into voting up, and we had all these Republicans talking. I mean, 300, 400 comments. It would have worked if they had just stuck with it, which they didn't. But we basically hired those people as community managers, not really so much to submit the stuff.
Not to submit.
And that worked brilliantly. And a lot of them still did it for a long time. And my idea was to put a level of journalism on top of Dig. Because when I would talk to Kevin, I'd be like, you know, you have these wrong stories on here and you have people posting PR stories. You see PR stories all the time on the front page. So I was like, what if
Dig and Reddit too. There's weird stuff that goes on there that they just don't control.
We knew.
Even when they think they are.
The 25 people who we had offered the money to, a lot of them told us they were getting paid $500, $200 to submit stories and to vote them up. So there was there's a massive underground economy.
My favorite thing is that the anti-Israeli Palestinian groups always come out on Friday afternoon and start posting because they want to hit when the Orthodox Jews are not using their computers for Shabbat. So
the old Shabbat.
So that gives them a little bit of a slight advantage in voting up the stories that they want to put up. And so every Saturday morning, there's the same on Reddit. There's the same ridiculous anti-Israel stories that they have every week on Saturday morning.
My vision was take the top 20 stories a day on Dig, and then put a journalist on each one and have them write a follow-up story.
Like actually investigate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I still think that's a brilliant idea, and I wish I could have executed on it. But imagine if the New York Times—
They do it anyway. It's called the local news. They're always like the third story on the local news is always, hey, there's a hamster dance on the internet.
Exactly. Well, now that's true. Actually, it's pretty funny, actually. It's like every time I watch local news, it's like, wait, I saw that yesterday. You know, some junior producer is like on Dig or YouTube's like most popular.
Just following up the story that they'd already done. Or, you know, the Today Show is doing some internet meme three days later.
But what if you actually had like a real journalist say, you know what, this story about, I don't know, iPhone, this iPhone leak, images or something like that. And they actually called three people and said, is it true at Apple? And they got like, officially Apple says no comment. We talked to two developers we know. They say this is correct. Like that would be a very cool service. And they actually added an editorial layer to Dig reluctantly, but because they had to, which was now it says this story is in dispute. Mm-hmm. So if enough people are like complaining about it, they put a little flag at the top.
About some story being just ridiculously.
Yeah. Like, Joel's a child molester, this story is in dispute. Well, thanks. I'm glad it's disputed that I'm a child molester, but.
But that becomes the headline now. Joel, child molester? The journalist.
Disputed. Disputed. Which saying disputed basically means some people do agree.
I got another question for you. So we did the money thing.
Right.
Let's do the investment thing. What would you do? Let's say that miraculously I were to just have a heart attack right here.
Yeah.
And you forged my will and now you're in charge of Stack Overflow.
Well, I would do CPR first. We'd try.
Easy what?
CPR.
CPR
I'd try to save
on
you.
Me. Thank you.
It wouldn't be pretty.
What would you do to Stack Overflow? Would you raise money? Would you... Because you've worked in the VC world.
Yeah. I mean,
Because you were like, you're an entrepreneur in residence.
Yep. I've done three companies. The first one I did by Silicon Reporter, I put money on my credit cards.
Right.
So I self-funded and off revenues. The second one, Weblogs Inc., I self-funded and we raised $200,000 or $300,000 from Mark Cuban as a seed investor. Mm-hmm. And in the third company, I raised $20 million.
Yeah.
So I've done basically all three, raise a lot, raise an angel, and raise nothing.
And you were, it was at Sequoia? You were in Sequoia?
I was EIR at Sequoia.
So you actually knew that you were going to take VC even before you had a company idea.
I mean, I basically said to myself, if I'm going to do a search engine, human-powered search, and try to solve this problem, who's got the most experience? And there was one company, there was one venture capital firm that had done both Yahoo and Google.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Sequoia.
Right.
So, and they did YouTube, which is a major driver of search now. So I was like, these guys know what they're doing. They did LinkedIn. They did Atari, Cisco. The fact that they did Atari.
Well, they didn't do. They funded.
Funded, yes. But that's what I mean by do. They didn't know. I mean, VCs, people, it's a whole mystique about VCs. Like
they like to think that they're starting these companies.
In some cases, and some VCs, like the VC I have on my board, Roloff Botha, was the CFO of PayPal. He did the YouTube investment. He knows that he's a VC who places a bet, finds a great entrepreneur,
right,
and then helps them when they need help.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a great VC does. But like some guy like Tim Draper, who I know, and I think he's a great guy, but you'd think that he's the CEO of the company. It's like he created Skype, because he's like speaking on behalf of Skype all the time.
Right.
A great VC like Fred Wilson here who did Twitter, he spoke yesterday and he's like, I can't speak for Twitter. I just made the investment. I was lucky enough to get in on it.
Yep.
Here's what they're saying. Let me amplify what they say. As opposed to being like, Tim Draper's like, Skype sold too soon. They didn't listen to me. It's just like, what? Shut up. You didn't make it. It wasn't your idea.
Right.
They're banks. They're just like a bank. So for you guys, the reason to raise venture capital is you don't have the money to fund it yourself, right? It's costing too much. It's a capital intensive project.
Well, that's not actually true. Stack Overflow?
Well, I'm saying this is a possible reason. So the reasons why people would raise.
If that were the case.
If it was the case. It's not the case, right? It's like you guys have office and servers and developers. Okay, problem solved.
Yeah.
But if you didn't have those things, two is you need to scale it, right? And you think there's a huge opportunity that cash would allow you to scale.
Right.
So you think that there's an opportunity to build 20 of these in 20 different tech verticals and you can't do it on your own, which I don't think is the case. Another reason is you want to cash out and you don't want to run it anymore. So you sell it to a VC or they buy some of it. You take some money off the table.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you would need to do that. I'm assuming you have profitable ventures in your day jobs, which means you can do this passionately.
Well, Stack Overflow has been paying for itself. And it's got a little bit of advertising there. It's got a business model behind the scenes. Hey, Jeff, can we talk about, are you going to have that thing up by the time the podcast goes live?
The business model?
Yeah, we might.
All right. So if you go to jobs.stackoverflow.com, that might give you a little hint.
Oh, is that it?
As to the business model. This may be.
Genius.
It is live. It's not linked to from the homepage yet.
So I can just, I'll Twitter it. That. Okay.
Okay,
I'll put that out to 70,000 people on Twitter. Yeah, that's a brilliant idea. I mean, that's obviously how you do it. Can I say what that is?
Yeah.
It's a job board.
Well, anybody, yeah, and
Elance,
fact,
whatever. Is it a project board or is it a job board?
Right now, it's a job board. Okay. It's gonna have other aspects to it. This is just the very, very, very
project
beginning.
Board would be great. I mean, too.
Yeah. There's gigs, there's jobs, there's sell to recruiters, sell to employers, and then they sell to the job seekers.
You should only be able to direct message somebody in the system if you've contributed a lot,
right,
or you pay like in mail, like LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
So LinkedIn makes a fortune. Like they charge $5 for you to in mail somebody.
That means you're not a member of LinkedIn and you want to contact somebody.
I'm not. You're not in my network, but I can contact them. So
right. You
can either do it by letting people post and pay, which is great. That's one way. But if I see somebody who's like the PHP guy and I want to contact him, if it says email this person, it's $1.
Right.
Or email this person, it's $2.
Yeah.
That would be pretty dope. You know,
yeah.
Like
yeah.
I would pay. I'm sure my guys would pay for that to just talk to them offline or something like that.
My assumption is you could come into Stack Overflow and say, I need a Hadoop expert.
Yeah.
Who is looking for a job and is willing to work in Los Angeles. And we can find those people.
I mean, even the expert, the other site is doing.
The site with a hyphen.
The other site with a hyphen. You, really.
We can say the name. It's not a problem.
Well done. You can always tell an amateur website when they put a hyphen in it, you know?
So it's not expert.
When somebody.
Change.
When, yeah, exactly.
The,
when everybody.
They had to put the hyphen there.
And if anybody hands me a business card and it's like iPhone dash. You know, cases dash leather. I'm like,
.info.
.info. Yeah, good for you. Okay, that's going to be a huge winner. I mean, I think there should be a filter that if anybody submits a business plan with a dash in it to a VC, it just like automatically goes to the shredder.
This is excellent. But you don't want to tell too many people this because this serves as a wonderful filter of like what a legit looking business is, right? You can sort of tell. Is the only method for paying PayPal?
Right.
Or do they have a merchant account?
Right, exactly.
That's a fantastic differentiator.
The good news is you guys have a really niche audience that is very highly compensated. You're going to have no problem making a business out of this. There's going to be 50 different ways to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The advertisers, now that you're above 2 or 3 million people, my theory is when you get to 100 to 250,000 people per day, mm-hmm. the advertisers just show up.
Cool.
And
well,
so,
I think they are starting to, yeah.
And so they're going to trickle in now. When Engadget got to 500,000, 600,000 people a day,
mm-hmm.
That's when the phone started ringing off the hook. And so I always believe in, on an advertising basis, is I love when people just show up, you know?
Yeah.
That's like the better, because then they want it, you know? Then you're just taking orders. So I would create an automated system where on the homepage, on the right-hand column or, you know, whatever, there were just, you know, 4 or 5 boxes or whatever, and you can buy them for a flat rate. It's like, this box is $5,000 a month. You have to buy 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And just put it up and just let people buy it. And it's like, there's no discussion. Put in your American Express card, and you sell 4 of those, you make $20,000 a month, make $250,000 a year, you're done.
That's it? I'm done with $250,000 a year?
Well, I mean, basically, you...
No. Don't say Tesla. He'll talk for 20 minutes about the Tesla.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you're following on Twitter. So we just hit 322. It looks like we're over 300,000 uniques today. But the thing that I've always thought is weird is they're a very, very finite audience for advertising developer tools, which is our natural audience. I mean, it doesn't support even one magazine anymore. There are no longer magazines for programmers.
That's not where people don't get information from magazines. That's why. The audience isn't there. But that doesn't mean the advertising dollars aren't there.
Yeah, I don't know if it there's a little bit of it, but I think it's kind of weak. I mean, the developer conferences are falling apart for lack of sponsors. And it's there, but
is that because people don't pay for tools anymore? It's all free?
They don't pay for tools, or they have better ways of finding out about tools.
Right.
So what I'm trying to figure out is, you want to advertise to programmers. Why can't you advertise them cars, plasma TVs, you know, the things that...
Those big advertisers just want reach, and you don't have it, and you never will. So
let's say it's a highly compensated audience of programmers that...
It's too much trouble for them to go into those niche markets. It makes sense that they would.
Yeah.
It's just there's too much friction to go buy 25 sites. And that's what people like Federated Media and other people are supposed to be solving. But they're probably not, right? It's hard. I mean, they're looking at, I could buy the Yahoo homepage for $1 million, get all these people. I could buy Google. I could buy this, and I could buy all these keywords. It's just more efficient. So advertising is like water going down a hill. It's going to take the most efficient route.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not the most efficient route for the plasma TV people. But it is the most efficient route for a server hosting company.
Sure.
So your server site, just on AdSense alone, is going to make a $10 effective CPM if you place the ads cleverly and, you know,
we have keywords, obviously. So, like, we know that we can put something on a .NET question or something on a Java question.
Make a self-serve ad tool, and you guys will make a fortune.
Got that, Jeff?
Well, we thought about that, but I don't know. I'm a little worried. We only accept certain classes. We're kind of strict about what we'll accept. Like, we believe in sort of what we call responsible advertising, which means we're going to leave money on the table, basically, because we don't want
flashing
aggravating ads. We don't want animation. We want things that are actually relevant and useful. It's kind of nice to have, you know how you talked about that editorial layer?
Yeah.
It's almost like you want an editorial layer for the ads.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I can't even go to the TechCrunch page anymore because, like, I just get blasted in the face with just a bunch of crap.
That's you know what, though? You're like, I got to tell you, developers are very unique in that, like, they give a shit about this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, the rest of the world doesn't care. You know, like,
but that's 90, our audience. That
I know.
Is our
and
audience.
That, so you have a unique issue there where, but yes. the truth is, the people who, I mean, if you're a developer, you've got ad blocker. I mean, the percentage of developers, you guys have ad blocker on your machines?
Mm, yeah, probably.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if you ask developers, they're like, well, why would I see ads? I have ad blocker. Ha, ha, ha. Screen capture. Yeah, you know, like, this is how it looks for me. Like,
so you're that's only developers that do that?
It's mainly developers and, like, 9/11 conspiracy theorists, which are very, you know, which are also pretty highly correlated.
It's not going to go well with our audience.
We got to get Adam, speaking of 9/11 conspiracy theories, we got to get Adam Curry on the show.
I know. What's up with that? He's just doing that for ratings. No, I mean.
He must be, right?
Everybody knows developers are a unique bunch. They are offended by ads. They can remove them. They're very empowered.
Yep.
So you do make a good point that you need to have something that will appeal to them. And I think if they sponsor the site, they will get a halo effect the way Woot has.
Right.
So if you just say to like the server farm people, like, just put up a white paper and we'll link to your white paper.
Mm-hmm.
They'll pay, you know, and you could put five links along the side, even if it's not, I mean, I understand people don't like the flashing ads. Five text link ads, and they each cost $5,000 a month, and you type in, you know, here's the HTML for the link, and then here's like two sentences, you get 300 characters.
I sort of wonder, our own hosting, who's our host, Jeff? Our web host or whatever data center thing?
It's Peak. But yeah, I want to make an observation. It's funny, Jason, you brought up early on the anecdote that you were copying software for like $50. It's like that whole conversation of like how can you make money on the site was like – seemed like the same exact conversation you would have about copying software.
Right.
You know, it's like it's all about the money. And I think this is one criticism of – I lobbied for you to be on the podcast because I think you've got some unique insight. Joel was the one that was very against it, for the record. But I will say this.
It's not true.
Joel is like,
I didn't want to do a podcast with a non-programmer. You're the first like non-programmer we've had.
I'm a tech guy. I mean, I was a programmer at some point.
But this is the thing that makes you a non-programmer. It's like the you're good at the money stuff, but that becomes the focus, right? Which I think for developers, that's not really the focus. So we have to be careful when we build the site. Like, we can't really take that tack because that's why I think developers sometimes react very negatively to you. Because
I don't know, you know, I got a lot of work for me who love me. So, but yes, I mean, listen, why people react negatively? There's a lot of reasons. So we can't. That would be a whole other podcast of why people don't like me. But I think you guys are probably not aggressive enough, and maybe I'm too aggressive, and the truth lies in between.
Yeah.
And so there's no shame in making money. You guys are putting a lot of hard work into this. Your audience is not going to be upset about you making money.
Hold on. Clarify, because this is the same thing with Mahalo. It's like digital sharecropping at some level. It is truly digital sharecropping. Like, we are, on some level, exploiting the people that are putting information on the site. And I'm always very aware of that. Like, I feel like
you feel like they're doing us a favor.
You know, digital sharecropping is a really, like, I'm sure that's like a really cool buzzword, but the truth is, like, we weren't digital sharecropping the bloggers on Weblogs Inc., nor are we digitally sharecropping the people on Mahalo. We're providing compensation when nobody else did. So Blogger provided no compensation. Weblogs Inc. provided serious compensation. Mahalo is going to provide with Mahalo 2.0, which we're launching, which we basically split the revenue 50-50 with people. I think it's going to be a truly transformative site. It would be like if the Wikipedia gave half the revenue to the best editor, or you guys gave half the revenue.
That would be like Google Knoll, which has been hugely successful.
Yeah, well, listen, I mean, you can say what you want, but, Engadget, Autoblog, and Joystick were, you know, the number one in their categories and some of the largest sites on the web. And, you know, that company, Weblogs Inc., that I sold, people say AOL overpaid, but AOL is making well over $1 million a month from those things. And users love those sites.
Really?
And Steve Jobs reads it daily.
How much did they pay? They paid $20 million for it?
Are
you allowed to say?
I'm not allowed to say, but there were reports of 25 to 30.
There are reports of, quote unquote. That's great.
So, you know,
so they have a good return on investment.
If you peel back the you know, sort of the digital sharecropping thing, we're compensating people who were previously not compensated. So that's like slavery versus some compensation, if you want to use the analogy. So I don't see it as digital sharecropping. If anything, you guys are giving no compensation. So you guys are in slavery and I'm in modest compensation. I mean, is that fair to call you guys slave drivers in Stack Overflow?
No, that's Experts Exchange, because you see what they did.
Yeah.
They started with the same model as us, where it's just like a big free open site.
And then they locked
and
everybody
out. Locked everybody out.
Yeah.
And started charging for
it. Well, that's kind of
nefarious. For all this content that they had never really paid
that's
for.
That's kind of nefarious. I believe, you know, people should be able to get some compensation for their contributions.
Right.
I don't see how that is digital sharecropping. I think people who like Dig, who everybody does it for free, or, you know, you guys, like, that would sound more like digital sharecropping to me.
Except that it's not, we're not even having that. I don't think we even look at it that way. We look at it as, you know, why are you at the site? It's voluntary.
Yeah.
It's because you're having fun, or you're improving your skills, or you're practicing your skills, or it's just, you know what people used to pay? Remember, like 20 years ago, people would go into bars and there was a Trivial Pursuit machine.
Yep.
And they would just shove quarters in there for the opportunity to answer trivia questions.
Right.
And that was all. You put in a quarter.
It was fun.
Like, A, C, B, D. And it's fun to just be able to.
And say, Mahalo Answers is no different.
Yep.
Except maybe we pay people. So, I mean, the digital sharecropping thing, I don't know. I mean, how is it digital sharecropping, and how are the sites any different?
What is sharecropping again? Anyway.
I think it just means that, like, we're taking advantage of people, like,
right.
And I don't see it.
Well, you know what? If you were to look at it in terms of bloggers, the difference between being a blogger on your own farm and being a blogger on Jason's plantation.
Right. But is that because
he gives you what he feels like giving you?
So I made a lot of money selling. Yeah, but by the way, we don't have a gun to any of their heads.
Of course.
They can leave anytime.
Yep.
And they own the rights to their words. And I designed the contract like that. Mm-hmm. Actually, AOL licenses for all time in digital the rights to people's words when they blog for them.
Uh-huh.
And we own a license on Mahalo Answers, but people own their copyright.
That's
and they can do anything they want with it. So we never claimed ownership of it. We don't have a gun to anybody's head to do this. So I would understand if it was digital sharecropping if there were a limited number of web pages allowed to be published on the internet every year, and I own 10% of them.
Right.
And it was like, you can only answer these questions on Mahalo Answers.
That'll probably happen soon, actually. Well,
that's not a bad business idea. There'd be like a tax on web pages, yes. And nobody's got a gun to their head. Nobody's being forced to do something. I think the problem is, for me, I'm kind of out there driving the Tesla, living the life, and I sold my company for a lot of money. So then everybody's like, oh my God, he's sharecropping everybody.
Right.
What they don't realize is there were a whole bunch of people who worked for Weblogs Inc. who became millionaires.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a whole bunch of people who had no jobs, were in school or transitioning jobs, who made incredible careers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we'll do the same thing with Mahalo and you know, the 2.0 product we're going to launch tonight. Basically, we're, instead of paying people 10, 20 bucks to build a page,
mm-hmm.
we're going to split the revenue with them. And I think the model would be the same as if you took the advertising revenue from a question in Stack Overflow and said, we're going to give you half the AdSense for having asked a good question that indexed well in Google and got us a lot of traffic.
Right.
And some of your question pages.
So then
probably
we're cutting a lot of $1.36 checks.
No, because you could have a minimum. But there are some questions. I'm sure the best question ever asked in Stack Overflow probably makes $100 a month in AdSense.
It's actually kind of surprising. There are a couple of questions like that.
Yeah.
Right? Like the programmer cartoon ones that have gotten, but they haven't got. It's actually kind of surprising. That's not. We try not to emphasize those super hot questions.
Well, that's right. We don't emphasize the super hot questions because it's a long tail.
140,000 page views is the most any questions ever
so
gotten.
So that makes. But
you know what's funny? Wait, I have to interject here because, Joel, you said.
140,000
page
views.
Every question was the programming cartoon
question. Of the life of the question.
That is. Isn't that Mahalo? Mahalo is like every question
it's a cartoon
should be the
question.
Programming cartoon question. We want to optimize for the most popular things, whatever that happens to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We really have one of the ways I used to explain Stack Overflow to people is it's the long tail Wikipedia for questions that are so long tail about a programming problem that only 10 people care about.
The Wikipedia would delete it.
Yeah, because it's not interesting.
Yeah.
And it's like literally, it's going to be useful for 10 people are going to be in that corner of that piece of that Microsoft compiler, and all 10 of them are going to have this problem, and we just want to be able to bring those 10 people together to solve it together. And, that times a million is what this kind of site is.
Now, Joel, one thing I want to interject here, and actually this goes back, you asked me way back when it got popped off the stack, but like, what's new with Stack Overflow?
Oh, yeah.
So we do have another domain name, superuser.com.
Yeah.
Which is going to be for the, I call this the Stack Overflow trilogy. So awesome. You got your Star Wars, you got your Return, you know, you got your Empire Strikes Back.
The best one.
Which was server fault. And now you got your Return of the Jedi, where things get crazy because now there's Ewoks. And yeah. That is superuser.com.
Yeah, that's the novice. It's the place for questions that don't fit on Stack Overflow or server fault, that are just questions about computers, questions about...
General. How do I reboot my iPhone?
Yeah, how do I... exactly.
Yes. Well, if it involves a computer, it's
turn it upside down and
that
shake.
Stuff could
I think
be, that could be very popular. Like we could actually have pages on SuperUser that got really, really popular.
Oh yeah,
because they would apply to anybody who has a computer.
Yeah, like
and
how
has
do I
problem?
How computer. Do I get back the minimize my
totally.
Desktop icon?
I think what you guys are building is a modern day Ziff Davis.
Wow.
Because if you think
those
about
guys, the
IDG
Ziff brothers
or
made
Ziff,
billions.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to tell you this, guys, but you could get rich off this. I know that's hard for you guys to handle, but this could be a really viable business.
Uh-huh.
I know you guys.
And then I'll hate myself.
Exactly.
Why would I want that?
I know you'll be driving a Tesla with your bulldogs, and you're gonna want to kill
I'll
yourself.
I'll just have to blog about how much I hate myself more.
Exactly.
Often.
Exactly. No, seriously. I mean, if you can get each of these sites up to a couple of million people, and you have, you know, a half dozen, a dozen of them, which is quite possible, you'll have a 20, 30 million unique network,
right.
And you'll be in the top 200 networks or top 150 networks on Quantcast, and the enterprise value of this business would be quite significant.
You want to buy some shares?
I would invest in Stack Overflow immediately.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Can I quote you on that?
I will invest. I'll buy 10% right now for. I would buy 10% of Stack Overflow for $100,000 right now on the spot.
So $1 million.
Easily, I would do that.
That's a ripoff.
All right. So, I have the $100,000. Tyler, wait, can you get the $100,000 out of the bag, please? Tyler's
oh my
got
God,
cash.
You've got it in cash.
We have cash. We brought cash today. No, I would invest $100,000 or $200,000 in this. I think it's going to be a big business.
Let me. I want to get a little bit off, and I have a question that. What's a good one? I didn't get such good questions this week. Darn it. Okay. Here, this is. We're changing the topic.
Got
180 degrees, and I don't know how to segue to it.
Hi, guys. This is Brian McKay in Tampa, and I recently read Dreaming in Code by Scott Rosenberg, and it's a good book. I liked it. It's about why software projects fail, and he brings up a lot of great ideas. And one of them is this concept that software is a super, super hard profession, just a very difficult discipline, and he goes as far as to say that he thinks software and surgery are two of the most difficult things that a person can attempt to do. And I disagree with that, although I've spoken to a lot of people that agree with it. And the general gist is that software at the highest levels, giant enterprise applications with millions of lines of code, are very difficult things to deal with. And to me, I don't know, I came up as a kid and then a teenager doing software, and now I had kind of a natural transition into doing this as a professional, and I'm working on reasonably large application, certainly nothing in the millions of lines of code, but some decent-sized things. And it never seemed all that crushingly difficult to me. So I'm wondering what you guys think. Is software this super hard thing that everyone should be afraid of, or is it just a profession? Thanks. Keep up the great work.
So anybody want to weigh in on that?
Well, surgery. There would be so many dead people if I
approached... surgery were hard.
Yeah,
oh, if
I was a surgeon and I did it the same way I did software, believe me, there'd be many, many, like just an army of dead people out
there.
Yeah,
compiling error is not so good in surgery.
That's true. You know, the way we approach software is you just make lots and lots of mistakes and you fix them all.
Yeah, that doesn't work in surgery. So immediately you have a hugely flawed analogy. In surgery, you don't make mistakes. Like you never make mistakes willingly. But in software, I think you it's all about making mistakes and just learning from those mistakes. And the learning part is the key part, right? And maybe that's the hard part. If you said something was hard, was that on some level, you have to like failure. And let me clarify that, is that you have to enjoy the problem-solving aspect of software, the puzzly aspect of it, where you just bang your head against this problem and you try all these different things. You're kind of like Edison with the light bulb. It's like, which filament is going to work? You know, is it going to be carbon? Is it going to be bamboo? You're just trying all these things. It's like 90% perspiration, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people just aren't cut out for that. Like I've met a lot of people that they just couldn't deal with the fact that you have to go down so many blind alleys and beat your head against the wall before you finally get to something that works.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing I would say that's hard about it. That's
think,
more of a mentality.
I think it is ridiculously hard. Jason, you have a...
I think it's hard. I mean, I also think it's the type of environment you're in. Like, and what you're building. I mean, the guys at 37 Signals, you know, they're like, oh, you know, we give people, you know, people work 3 hours a day, and they, you know, like, I'm like, really?
Yeah.
But they make software that has no features.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I made Microsoft Word and it had seven features, guess what? I would love my job as a programmer, and I'd be like, this is so great. Programming's easy. But if I'm making financial software, you know, that can't go down, you know, to track, you know, whatever, commodities exchanges, or I'm trying to track, you know, thousands of votes a second, and my memcaches and this, and keeping pages up to date, and you know, the server
or
infrastructure,
Twitter,
and I have to build, you know, 30 million users news feeds, like, you know, or 100 million users news feeds. Like, these are very hard computational problems.
Dig is sort of Twitter is the scale of problem of like the phone system or like the Visa credit card.
Yeah, Facebook with the social graph. It's like I have 5,000 people on Facebook. When I log in, it takes 90 seconds for me to log in if it works.
Right.
Because it's true. And I talked to Zuckerberg about it. I talked to people about it. They're like, yeah, when you log in, you realize like 18 servers have to go to work to like when I log into Facebook, I think it – or Scoble does. I think it uses like – I think – we put about 20 pounds of carbon into the air every time we log into Facebook. But those kind of problems are hard.
Yeah, they are definitely.
And they're never ending.
Yep.
You know, like they're like, let's
I'm
add
more
seven features.
That you have 5,000 friends. That's surprising.
Hell.
I'm just kidding.
I have a lot of friends. You know, the thing is, I tell you when it changed for me in terms of that was when I was in the competition with Dig, I just pissed off a lot of 14-year-old kids who now follow me around the web and are like, I used to have like my aim open, and like during that whole time, like my aim would go off every 5 minutes. Like, why are you trying to get Time Warner to kill Dig? And I was like, who is this? And I was like, how old are you? And it's like a 12-year-old kid. And I'm like, listen, I got Time Warner to offer a lot of money for Dig. I tried to get Kevin in to get the company bought when, you know, it was very young. And I offered him a bunch of money I offered him $4 million for Dig when it was like 6 months old.
Nobody, you know, there's a problem. No entrepreneur will take $4 million for their company.
Entrepreneurs are going to take any money for their company. They're
going
to just build. It's like poker play. They fall in love with a hand.
Yep.
And they just can't let it go. It's like, I got pocket aces. I'm going to that.
It's necessary because otherwise they would not be an entrepreneur. They would not. They have to have that suspense of disbelief that makes them think that their thing is worth $100 million or they're never going to get over those first few months.
Zuckerberg believes that he's building the next Microsoft and that he is the next Bill Gates.
Yeah.
That he believes that in his heart. And you know what? The Pointcast guys believe that too.
Good luck with that. Pointcast was that thing that they
really
had
annoying push server.
Yeah.
That.
Yep. It was a screensaver that showed you news headlines.
Basically, it was RSS before RSS. It would download all the news stories and show them in a screensaver. It was like an RSS reader. It was pretty cool for a minute. Then people installed it at their offices.
Yep.
And it downloaded videos and images. And people had like 1T1 for their whole company or a DSL line or something.
And the first thing the system did is filter out that shit.
And so it was like every hour, let's download everything.
Yeah.
You know, and it would be like, what are you interested in? And it'd be like, check all.
I thought for a while that their business model was going to be to sell a server that the companies could put inside the firewall.
It was. Also, it was going to be like Lotus Notes. Like, you could also build custom applications into it. So, like.
But think about that business model. That's like, nice T1 you have there. I hope nothing happens to it. I have a little service you can buy.
Yeah, exactly.
You can protect your T1 from my buddies.
Yeah, it'd be like, your BitTorrent. We're gonna have the Pirate Bay local copies of all the top movies on the Pirate Bay in Fog Creek, since everybody here is robbing
save
movies.
Your traffic, exactly. Building the next Microsoft, but it's not just that. I think it's even people that have small companies are always going to look at what is actually a pretty reasonable valuation for their company. You know, $1 million a developer or whatever the metric you use is.
It depends. I think selling your company It really depends. Like Silicon Airport, I got offered money for and I didn't sell. It depends on how emotionally tied you are to it and also where you're at in life, you know? Mm-hmm. And when you're younger, I think sometimes people believe like, this is the one idea I'm ever going to have and this is the greatest idea in the world. And then you get a little older and you're like, I've had like 3 good ideas. Okay, I'm going to have a fourth and a fifth probably.
Right. And you didn't even have time to do half of the good ideas that came up.
People who are smart have, you know, a good idea every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, I've met people who, you know, have a good idea like 3 times during dinner. Like every idea they have is a $1 million idea and they're not millionaires. And I'm like, why are you not totally like a billionaire by now? These ideas are brilliant and they just
don't pursue them.
I mean, Stack Overflow as an idea, it was out there. I mean, the fact that it took so long for somebody to make Stack Overflow, Yahoo Answers, Google Answers, Right. Stuff's been out for a decade.
This actually did blow me away when I thought about how often I landed on Experts Exchange as a result of a programming problem.
Right.
And just how bad the experience was. It kind of blew me away that programmers who always built stuff for themselves had not done this yet.
Right. Well, they're too busy because they got clients. They got some boss where's the thing from last week?
Oh, but they're making open source projects. They made every possible. I mean, somebody made Mercurial and Git, and these are just the newest things.
Right. But there's a lot of ideas out there. Like, if you think, gee, Stack Overflow is a really brilliant idea, nobody did.
Yeah.
What are the other 20 brilliant ideas that nobody did?
Sure. Just
they're out there.
Yep.
And probably there's 100 people listening who just have this brilliant idea.
So get out there and do it, and maybe Jason will.
Well, you know what the thing is? There's no downside risk. That's the thing everybody forgets if you live in America.
Yeah.
If you live in America and you start a company and you fail, you close the company, you start a new one the next day. Like Stack Overflow fails, you start Stacked Overflow.
Or you go get a job.
Or you go get a job. Like, what's the downside risk?
You get your own job back, your old job back.
There's no risk.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you have like some huge mortgage and kids or something. But generally speaking, there's not much risk.
So one topic I do want to cover before we close the podcast. One of your favorite, and I guess, Jason, you're not blogging anymore. You have this crazy newsletter thing you're doing.
Yeah, I went email newsletter.
Okay. Well, I guess I'd love to get into that, but we don't have time to get into that, sadly. I would love to see that information become public, obviously. I'm a big fan of public information.
I'm putting it on my blog now because too many people complain.
Well, exactly, because I want to benefit from
it. So you've now done the Dave Weiner loop 3 times.
Yeah, I basically have turned into Dave Weiner. I love you. I hate you. I love you. No, I think I hate you.
So I really appreciate some of the blog entries you've put up. Like, I don't always agree with what you're saying, but I appreciate like the honesty and the transparency. And I think that's what I object to is like with the email, it's like there's less transparency. It's not really the Jason that I sort of knew and grown to grudgingly like. But one of my favorite things you posted was about the craziness of SEO.
Yeah.
Why people hate SEO and why SMO is bullshit.
Right.
And I love that, right? Because every developer knows that this SEO stuff is just kind of snake oil. And for you to say it was incredible. And I never was able to follow up because I know a lot of the SEO gurus sort of challenged you and took on this challenge of like trying to optimize your page results and all this other stuff. Yeah. And what was the final outcome of all that?
Not much. I mean, essentially this all started because I said at some conference, like they're like, oh, Engadget has the number one ranking for Palm, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you have a ranking better than Palm itself.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, who's your SEO expert? What are you doing at our site?
Yeah,
and this is like in 2004. And I'm like, SEO? I didn't know what it stood for. I literally didn't know what it stood for. And the guy, he's like, search engine optimization. I'm like, oh, you mean like those guys who call you and want you to give them $5,000 a month for 24 months in a locked-in contract? I said, that's bullshit. Like, just build great content. It seems to go to the top of the page, you know, if you build good stuff.
Yep.
And they were like, oh, my God. And I was like, why is everybody upset? They're like, this is a whole room full of SEOs. I was like, I thought this was a search conference. They're like, yeah, that's what search conferences are filled with. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry.
It's crazy.
But they're actually the against search, right? Because their goal is to somehow undermine the they say optimization, and then the good ones are obviously trying to optimize to help you achieve your natural position on the Google results.
The problem is there are 1,000 people who will make the case that they should be number one for PHP.
Sure.
And you guys have a claim to that, and Wikipedia has a claim to that, and O'Reilly, and everybody.
And those are just the legit ones.
And those are just the legit ones. Then there's 10,000 people who are the, 100,000 people illegitimately trying to get that. So then what happens is Google doesn't know how to do it. So what does Google do? Google's like, we're going to get it right like 6 out of 10 times, and the rest of you can fight it out. Well, if it's inefficient, and there's these landing pages and all this other stuff going on, guess what? Google makes more money.
Mm-hmm.
The more inefficient searches, the more imperfect it is, the more money is going to get made because people click on the ads, because the ads are then more relevant than some of the bad search results.
So you don't think they would hurt their results to improve ad clickage?
That's an interesting segue. That would be like X-Files level. I would never say that because we would probably like – there's some guy on a rooftop over there who's going to shoot and kill all of us and shoot the machine that's recording this call.
No, because I actually believe – I think that when Google says don't be evil, that's specifically what they mean.
Yes. However –
That's a specific form of evil that they wouldn't do.
But the inefficiency of search leads to all these people playing the game, buying ads, all this stuff. So it does benefit them that the search result isn't perfect. So it does lead one to believe that maybe a little inefficiency is good. But well, who knows?
Presumably there's somebody in some finance department at Google, but every time they try to say this, let's just not worry about this search inefficiency.
Yeah.
And they just get shouted down.
Yeah.
By because Larry and Sergey are really
Yeah, they're not motivated by that.
Side. Yeah.
No.
And they're doing so well anyway. What do they have to? They don't have to.
No. But basically the end result is they can't tell you how to make a perfect result and how to get that, you know, top 10 ranking, top 20 ranking. And so everybody then goes to the next best thing, which is an SEO. And then the SEO sells them the belief that they actually deserve it.
Right.
And what I always do is I tell my people and the people who are freelancers for us, and people say, oh, you're making landing pages. I always tell them, if our page, our topic page, if you will, our search result, human edited, is not better than the top 10 pages in the Google result, don't expect to get ranked. Mm-hmm. But look at the top 10 and figure out a way to make a page that's better than those. So if you look at our 2009 stimulus page, it's probably the best page on the internet for that topic, or one of the top three or four. Mm-hmm. And if people spend the time to make a page that's better than everything else in the top 10, then you have a legitimate case for getting in there. But if you're just making thousands of blogs or whatever people are doing,
right.
You know, they
spam,
and then Google's going to catch you, and it's not worth it. So the reason right. We've done well, and the reason why the other blogs did that we did in Weblogs Inc. did well was because it had high quality content. Mm-hmm. And we were paying people to write high quality content, therefore it ranked.
Right.
And if you do that for long enough, the domain name gets
pretty much forget the search engine optimization.
You don't really have to worry about it.
Yeah, you should pay attention to what your URLs look like. You should have the meta tags. You should have
that's the blocking and tackling.
Right.
You should get that right. Like
get that right anyway. But a lot
of sites don't get that right though.
And that's true.
People have said there's like three questions every day. There's a new question on Stack Overflow about how does Stack Overflow rank so well in Google. And it's not like something we set out to do.
Yeah, I went to Google and I talked to them.
I left an envelope next to the free ice cream machine, the soft ice cream machine with $1,000 in it.
Yeah, doing the right things and sort of like Joel was saying, having clean URLs, having like simple page layout, having header blocks that make sense. This is all web design 101.
Yeah,
but then the high quality really content just totally dominates though. Yeah.
But if also, you really think about updated
SEO, though, it's you want a life coach. You're asking these people to be a life coach for you to tell you, how can I be awesome? Because if you're awesome, people are going to link to you, right?
Yeah.
It's like PR companies.
How do you become awesome?
It's like PR companies. People go to SEO and PR companies to get them to rank them when, in fact, they suck.
Yeah.
So, like, I never had a PR person. I never had a PR company.
Really?
No. I mean, I have Tyler, who works with me, who does strategy, and we basically get inbound flow. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll be like, we're in New York. We should go on Joel's thing because he mentioned us a couple of times and he invited us.
Yep.
And that's how we do PR.
Right.
You know, like I email
I guess
you.
That's
and
how
like,
I do PR too.
Yeah. It's authentic. And then there's people who have nothing going on.
There's still value to PR agencies. Like I've noticed that like TechCrunch is never going to cover us because I don't know why, but because nobody's pitching them. We're not going to pitch them. We don't bother.
I'll take care of that.
All right. Thanks. No, even I even remember the days of Silicon. I worked at Juno Online Services.
Yeah, we covered Juno big time.
Yeah, not that much.
Right.
Which we were happy about at Juno because Silicon Alley Reporter was sort of like the people that had parties in Juno. We thought we were serious. We just had customers.
So did you have a 1400 on your SATs? You had to, what's your SATs? This is back in the old days when SATs were 1600. You had to have over 1200 to work there or 1300?
Yes, you did have to have.
Was it 1400 or 1200? What was the cutoff? You know.
I don't remember them
You're
being a specific
such a
cutoff.
Liar. So what was your SATs?
I'm not telling you.
You know, did you get 1,500 on your SATs? Make them tell us.
I'm not gonna tell you.
Or just tell us the math.
I got really
out of 800, you scored perfect.
Oh, okay. We got a perfect math. That's a given. He's always complaining that everybody should have a perfect math score.
No, on the APs. On the APs, not on the.
Did you get 800 in math? Yes or no?
I'm not going to answer.
That's
any
a
of these
yes
questions.
Or no question. I've been so
I was
honest
a real
on this
nerd
podcast.
In college, I was a real nerd in college. And I went to an Ivy League institution, and I got
a
3.9 GPA.
Harvard.
No, the other one.
Yeah.
So that's all I'm going to say. Yes. And now I'm going to have to delete this from the podcast because it's too embarrassing.
It's okay. I'm going to Twitter right now. Joel has got – why are you so embarrassed? Don't be so self-loathing.
It's not self-loathing.
It's a little
self-deprecating.
Self-deprecating would be, I am a complete nerd. I wasted 3 hours a day after school in SAT prep class, and all I got for it was 1550.
No, I didn't take SAT prep. Let me tell you something.
That would be self-deprecating.
I don't want to talk about the SATs because that was a billion years ago. But in college, I did not know how to not get an A. I hate to say this, but I could not do anything less than the maximum amount of work for a class.
Was that because like, you were hardworking or because you just knew how to navigate the grading system?
There was a knob, and I knew how to turn it all the way up and get an A.
Uh-huh.
I thought that if I turned it down even a little bit, I might get an F and my life would end.
So you had clarity.
I guess so.
And you were neurotic.
Yeah, neurotic. That's it.
You had clarity on how to achieve the goal and a large amount of neurotic. Well, that makes for a good entrepreneur.
Juno, we got into this because Juno Online Services was owned by D.E. Shaw, and D.E. Shaw was notorious for asking for grades and GPAs and stuff.
Right. Who was the guy who ran Juno? I remember him.
Charles Arday.
Yeah, he was a nerd.
He was an extreme nerd. He's now a mystery fiction editor or something.
Really?
He has his own, I think, mystery magazine.
Sweet.
Yeah. Can't remember the details.
He did well. But anyway, PR. We were talking about SEO and PR. I think those SEO and PR people, they prey off the fact that people who don't have anything going on, they're like, we can make you seem hip and cool, and we can make your pig into this beautiful thing. We're going to put some lipstick on it, and you're going to be the hottest company in Web 2.0. And it's like, your shit still sucks.
That's the thing. If the stuff is good, it'll draw an audience anyway. Like we don't
exactly.
We got our audience without too much traditional coverage, so to speak. I mean, we got Scoble linked to us once, but it was really, and in fact, with Stack Overflow, the whole reason that Jeff and I did it together is we thought this thing needs critical mass. We're both bloggers with a big readership of programmers. We can get at least the critical mass to get it started.
Brilliant. If you guys quantcast it and then put the two sites together as a network, then people will start.
What is Quantcast? I don't even know.
Quantcast is like Compete, except they put a pick tracking pixel, like analytics.
Oh.
And it will actually rank all the sites in the United States by the actual traffic. And it says quantified or not quantified. And it will also put together networks of sites. So people don't know this, but I own Hackaday, because it was one of the blogs we started at Weblogs Inc., but we couldn't sell it to Time Warner, or I wouldn't sell it to Time Warner because they were like, can you take down this post on how to hack your Time Warner cable box?
So I was like,
no. And they're like, no, it's site's totally fine. We just can't have any
just
hacking of cable modems or modems in general or computers. And I was like, okay, you can't have it. So anyway, that like Mahalo owns that, so it gets a little bit of traffic. Uh-huh. But you can put those two things together and call it the Mahalo Network. So you can have the Stack Overflow Network, have all three sites bundled as one. And right now, you guys would be like the 350th or maybe 500th largest site in the United States. And that's when VCs, everybody's going to start paying attention. But you guys just stick to your knitting. I mean, you have beautiful software you've built, and it seems like you could roll one of these out every 2-3 months with a great name, with a great audience, make it perfect, add features slowly, and listen to the community. You're going to have 20 million uniques. I don't think you guys know what you're sitting on right now.
Some of us do.
Yeah. It's pretty huge, dude. I mean, it's going to be a very big business. It's got dig-level potential, except it's going to be in a category that can actually make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Because you have endemic advertisers.
I'm never going to be able to get those blue, yellow Adidas that Kevin Rose can get.
You can't pull those off.
You can't get those shoes. It's too bad this isn't a video podcast, because those are pretty sweet, those Asics.
Yeah. But I tried to get the shoes that Kevin Rose got.
Yeah.
I think there was a podcast where he's driving all around San Francisco trying to get them, so I'm just not going
to
ever.
That dude needs to get back to work. Seriously, dude.
Back to work, Kevin.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have him on the show sometime.
Kevin's awesome. Kevin and I are good friends. People are like, oh my God, you and Kevin Rose. And I was like, Kevin Rose and been friends since before, like, well, since the first week he started Dig.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've known him forever.
Where'd you know him from?
Well, he was in L.A. I was in L.A., and he was doing G4, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, right.
He was an intern or something at G4. He was behind the scenes.
Tech TV.
Right, Tech TV. But he would come on like as like this little kid from the back room.
Yeah, he was
awkward. Like, you see these like original videos of him. And
it's funny.
Then I was in London at this Future Web Apps thing, and he's hosts a Dig Live.
Dig Nation Live.
When I tell you there's 1,000 people in the audience, 1,500 people, screaming and going crazy.
Right.
Then afterwards, it's a party.
We did that. We did that at Mix. In Las Vegas, Jeff, and we got what, 30 people?
Yeah, and they were going crazy. These at the after party for it, they had to put Kevin in a VIP area that was like a square area next to a staircase with a balcony all around it. And there's literally like hundreds of kids leaning over the balcony, like handing their iPhones to Kevin with like Sharpie pens to get him to autograph their iPhones or handing down their MacBook Air. And I'm like, dude, this is like the Beatles or something.
But they're boys.
Well, yeah, that kind of does make it strange.
That is a little strange.
No, but there were girls too. I mean,
he does have a...
He signs breastises.
Wow.
Women we're not at that level yet, Joel. We got to get there.
Well, I was going to ask if Joel would sign my breasts.
That's it.
That's it.
You're cut off.
That's a show.
That's a show.
That's ending the podcast. That's a podcast ender.
Jump the shark.
to our listeners, if you have any questions for a future edition of this show, please call our podcast hotline, 646-826-3879, or email an mp3 to podcast@stackoverflow.com. There's also a transcript page where you can write up transcripts of this page. Dedicated volunteers around the world type all this crap in for the hearing impaired, and that's going to be linked to from the show notes, which, as always, are at blog.stackoverflow.com. See you next week.
See you next week.
Thanks for being on, Jason.
That was fun.
It was good. I had to be a little mean to you because Joel was being way too nice. I think it's because he's right there.
Joel's a nice guy. It turns out Joel's a nice guy.
Yeah.
It's okay. Sorry,
so I had to be the bad guy because nobody was being the bad guy.
Conflict equals drama equals writings.
You've been listening to Stack Overflow with Jeff Atwood and Joel Spolsky.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Joel Spolsky. Our website editor was Jeff Atwood. The series producer is Jeff Atwood.
This is Phil Windley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great presentation from Stack Overflow here on IT Conversations.